Diaz versus the people. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Elizabeth Griffin appearing on behalf of Mr. Zamarripa Diaz. I'm going to start with the first issue that the court granted cert on. Mr. Zamarripa Diaz was charged with first-degree burglary with the allegation that he committed a menacing in the home. He submitted two lesser offenses, second-degree burglary, which is a lesser included, and the non-included of criminal trespass. The court instructed the jury, you should not consider the lesser included offense of second-degree burglary unless your verdict on first-degree burglary is not guilty. The prosecution began his, He told the jury to begin their deliberations by looking at the verdict form, which is where that instruction appeared, and that they may only consider the lesser if they unanimously found him not guilty of first-degree burglary. Our plain error rule under Rule 52 is well established. The defendant.
Just before you go there, who submitted the instructions? And I guess I didn't realize when I was looking at the case that there was also a lesser not included. Was that the source of the error? The instruction on the lesser non included was also used for the lesser?
I guess I don't. Well,
maybe I misunderstood.
We submitted both lessers. And I don't understand the rest of the question.
You say the defendant submitted the lessers.
Yes.
And did you not say, or did I mishear you, that there was a lesser included and also a lesser not included?
Correct.
So, in submitting those instructions, the lesser not included presumably was instructed correctly. And was the instruction regarding the lesser not included the source of the error for the lesser included? That is, was it the same instruction or something?
No. Well, I'm still not sure I understand, but...
Can I ask
another
way? Did
the defense submit the instructions?
Yes.
No, but there's something else. The hard transition versus soft transition issue. What was used was the same transition, the hard transition used for both the lesser included and the lesser non-included? That's, I think, what Justice might
well,
you
know,
do you
I'm
know?
Not, I'm, that's a good question. I'm not sure about that. And where I would look is the verdict form for the criminal trespass, because that's where the jury was actually instructed in the instructions, don't consider the lesser included unless you find him not guilty of first-degree burglary. And then the court, of course, repeated that in the oral instructions, and the prosecutor told them to go there first. Okay, so the error in this instruction was not objected to, and so Mr. Zamarripa Diaz had to show that it was plain error. And our plain error rule under CRIM P52D is well established. The defendant has to show three things: that the error is obvious, that it affected a substantial right, and that there was a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the conviction.
I'm sorry to interrupt again with a distraction, but if the defense submitted them, shouldn't we be having a discussion about invited error?
No, I'm sorry, Judge. The defense admitted the lesser instruction. The defense didn't submit the instruction about not considering the lesser unless they convict of the greater.
Was that as part of a carrying instruction, or how were these jury instructions set up? Do you know what I mean by a carrying instruction? We call it a transition instruction.
Yes.
Was that what that was?
The stock bridging instruction or transition instruction was given, which is, if you're not satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt, then consider the lesser.
Okay, and then I think the thing that we have been trying to get to is, as far as you can recall from your review of the record, there was only one bridge instruction that bridged into both the lesser included and the lesser not?
As far as I know, and I apologize, this wasn't my case in the Court of Appeals, and I'm sure that's really clear if the court looks at the instruction.
Well, I have a little bit of an instruction in front of me, not the entire packet, that seems to suggest that they're going to be given five forms of verdict and they have to unanimously agree upon the verdict. Now, that's not what you're complaining about, right? You're trying to focus in more on a very specific caring or bridging instruction then?
Well, it's not actually the bridging instruction. It's the verdict form.
The verdict form is what you're worried about?
Yes. The verdict form for first-degree burglary tells the jury, you may not consider the lesser-included offense of second-degree burglary unless your verdict on first-degree burglary is not guilty. The court read that to the jury in reading the instructions, and the prosecutor told the jury to start with the verdict form and told them the verdict form tells you that unless you unanimously acquit him of first-degree burglary, you can't consider second.
Okay. Thank you.
Could I just stop here one second? Just,
sure.
So that last thing you said, the judge didn't tell them that. The judge told them to read the verdict form and do what it said. And then you're saying the instructions, if they read and made the connections, it told them that they had to have a unanimous verdict with regard to the first. The judge didn't say you can't consider the second unless you unanimously agree that he was not guilty of the first.
The judge read the regular unanimity instruction.
The regular what? I'm sorry.
That your jury told them their verdicts had to be unanimous.
Yeah.
Which this court generally construes as applying to everything. And the court read them the wording on the verdict form, which told them, don't consider first-degree burglary unless you find him not guilty of first-degree burglary. And then it was the prosecutor who really made it express in his closing argument and said, okay, start with that verdict form because that verdict form tells you that you have to unanimously acquit him of first before you consider second. So it's all of those things together.
Okay. Just one other. You talked about this, the pattern sort of bridge instruction. Was that given separately, or was the only bridge between first and second what appeared in the verdict form?
I believe the regular stock bridging instruction was given. And I would ask the court to verify that for me. But I believe it's the stock instruction. And the thing about our stock instruction is that it's very vague. And so it can take on kind of whatever meaning is argued. It says if you're not satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt, then you can consider the lesser. And when the DA explains to them, that means you have to unanimously acquit, it's very consistent with that. And so it really takes on that meaning. Okay. The three things the defendant has to show plain error is that the error is obvious, that it affected substantial right, and there's a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the conviction. It's that last part that's really at issue here, and this court has developed that last part in the context of instructional error by saying, in determining if there's a reasonable possibility it contributed to the conviction, you review the entire record, but in particular, you look at whether the evidence was overwhelming on the subject matter, whether the subject was contested, and whether the other instructions cured or corrected the error. Okay? And this court has said consistently that those errors that are obvious, affect a substantial right, and may reasonably have contributed to the conviction are plain errors which undermine fundamental fairness and cast doubt on the reliability of the verdict. And I just want to point out that I focused on more recent cases from this court, but if you look at the cases that are cited in those cases, they go back to the 90s, the 80s, and this standard has been around for a long time. The Court of Appeals affirmed, based on the fact that there was sufficient evidence to support a verdict on a first-degree burglary. So the analysis that the Court of Appeals performed was completely wrong. And in Oman, this court said, although it shouldn't even need to be said, but this court said, look, we're not deciding if there was sufficient evidence. We're looking at if it was overwhelming, if it was contested, and if the other instructions cured the error. Under the correct analysis, Mr. Zamora Padilla established plain error. First of all, the error affected his substantial rights to proof beyond a reasonable doubt and a unanimous jury verdict. And the cases that talk about that are in my briefs. They're Rivera, Keeble, Beck, and Lewis. And they explain very clearly how the lesser included offense instruction is essential to ensuring the right to trial by jury, guarding against improper conviction, ensuring that the jury will accord the defendant the full benefit of the reasonable doubt standard. And Lewis is the case that talks about jury unanimity. There's a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to his conviction because there was no other instruction that corrected the error. And as we already discussed, the bridging instruction is really ambiguous. And it sort of takes on whatever meaning somebody tells the jury it has. And in this case, the verdict form actually told the jury, you can't consider the lesser unless you find him not guilty of the greater. The element distinguishing first and second degree burglary was menacing, a menacing committed in the home. And that issue was contested. And we know it was contested because, first of all, the defense tendered the second degree burglary instruction. And the reason they tendered that instruction was because there were two parts to their defense to the burglary. And the two parts were, one, he didn't have the intent to steal anything inside the house, and that's a defense to both. But two, also, he didn't place or attempt to place the homeowner in fear of imminent serious bodily injury. And if you think he had the intent to steal, but you don't think he menaced, then he's only guilty of second-degree burglary.
Regarding the evidence supporting that second theory,
yes.
Do I correctly understand that there was no direct evidence? The only way that you could say that was supported would be if the victim's testimony were disbelieved.
No. Oh,
okay.
I'm sorry.
Please explain that to me then.
Yeah, no, I really apologize if my brief left that impression.
Maybe my apology that's necessary, but if you would explain it anyway, please.
Okay. Yeah, no, the evidence is not anywhere near overwhelming. And what I said was, even if you take everything that the homeowner said as true, and she's the only witness to the altercation, but if you take everything that she said as true, it's not overwhelming evidence that my client placed or attempted to place her in fear of imminent serious bodily injury, because what she said was she sees him in the house, she gets this adrenaline rush, she goes in and confronts him, he runs away, she chases him into the kitchen, she uses her hand-to-hand combat training to pin his arm behind his back, he's trying to get out the kitchen window, and he takes a swing at her with this arm. And she says, it's not a straight jab like this, because she's behind him, it's a swing out like this. That is not overwhelming evidence that he placed or attempted to place her in fear of imminent serious bodily injury. And the defense argued he was just trying to get away, and that's corroborated by the fact that as soon as she released him and showed him where the door was, which was apparently his problem.
Is the idea that it's not a swing at her, it's just a movement, or is the idea that it's not that serious a swing?
Well, she testified he took a swing at her. Whether or not you interpret that as, you know, he obviously he's trying to get away. And he can only do so much because he's face forward. But to place somebody or attempt to place somebody in fear of imminent serious bodily injury, you've got to mean business. And he's just trying to get away. Even if, and as
well, do you have to mean business? I thought that serious bodily injury is like any is defined rather broadly and includes a lot of rather minor injuries.
Well, breaks and fractures, it doesn't include bruises. It includes, from what you can get from a punch, it's got to be a pretty serious injury. If you just bruise somebody, that's not serious bodily injury.
Ms. Griffin, Mr. Lee characterizes it as the defendant swung his closed fist at her. The swing was, he puts in quotes, pretty forceful. And without her evasive action, the defendant would have hit her in the face. Is that accurate?
I don't think so. I don't think there was any testimony at all that the swing was forceful. She testified he took a swing at me on her direct testimony, and then the prosecutor stopped and slowed her down and took it question by question, and he said, was his fist open or was it closed? And she said, oh, it was closed. And then he said, well, would have made contact with you if you hadn't ducked? Yeah. Where would it have hit? She said, probably my face. I don't I think she said it was forceful. I mean, I could be wrong about
that. She says pretty forceful, but...
Yeah, no, I don't think that she testified about the force involved. And that was the defense argument in closing, was that, look, you know, this was just one of these. This was not a punch aimed at her face, and there was no evidence of that. And, you know, the issue is whether there's overwhelming evidence for purposes of plain error review, because it's contested, because there's an obvious error in the instruction that's not cured by any of the other instructions. The jury very well may have found second-degree burglary if it hadn't been given this wrong instruction, that they couldn't consider it unless they unanimously acquitted him at first. And I just want to point out, too, that the testimony was that he was only in the home with her for a total of 12 to 13 seconds before they both ran outside. So this all happened very fast, and as the court knows, Mr. Zamora-Padillas was very drunk. Did the court have any other questions on that, or I'm going to move on to my...
Let me just ask you before you move on, if we agreed with your argument, what's the remedy?
Well, I think... since the defense tendered second-degree burglary, that the court could either order a new trial on first or order judgment entered on second-degree burglary for this error, because this error only goes to that issue. The second issue is that Medina, this court's decision in Medina and due process require a district court to give the defense an opportunity to be heard prior to asking juror questions at trial. And the court didn't do that in this case, and so therefore a new trial is required.
Well, the prosecution's argument on the Medina application of Medina case is that Medina was dealing with pilot project jury instructions, and that's not required once jury questioning became the official rule. What's your position?
Well, Medina addressed a slightly different issue, which was whether allowing any jury questions violates due process, or whether the procedures in the pilot project were good enough to protect the due process rights of the defendant. And that's the way the court looked at it. And what the court decided in Medina is that the protections in the pilot project were good enough. But the court was really careful to say several times that there's no due process violation where appropriate safeguards are imposed. And the court, in its holding at the beginning of the case, singled out consulting with counsel before asking the question as the most important safeguard.
Well, I didn't quite get that from that case. Could you elaborate on that? I thought it was merely quoting what the pilot project rules required, or paraphrasing.
Well, let me, hold on. What the court said, this is in both my opening and reply brief, we hold that juror questions of witnesses does not create a per se violation of a defendant's right to a fair trial when the applicable rules of law and evidence are applied, and after consulting with counsel, the decision of whether to ask a juror's question is committed to the sound discretion of the trial court. And that's just the most clear statement in the case. But there are other places in the case where the court says, well, here we are again. Sorry. I think it was at page 851 of the case. The court says, we are confident that with adequate safeguards in place, a defendant's constitutional rights will be protected. Should a juror propound an inadmissible question, or should a juror's bias manifest itself through the questioning of a witness? Under the terms of the pilot project, the trial judge, and there's an ellipsis in there, with the advice of counsel, screened the jurors' written questions. So, I mean, I think that was front and center in Medina, and I think the court, my interpretation was the court was making an effort to make it clear that at the very least, you've got to consult with counsel before.
In this case, could you remind me of the sequence, what happened? I know your objection is that the defense counsel was not consulted prior to giving that juror question or stating the juror question. But could you just run through what the judge did do?
Yes. Okay. The court didn't tell the attorney that there was going to be juror questions. And then when he was giving his introductory remarks to the jury, he said, you can submit written questions after each witness. And here's what he said. If I believe it's a proper question, I will ask it. He said he might not ask it because of the rules of evidence, but if he does, the lawyers will get to follow up. And then he asked after each witness if the jury had questions. And the first time questions were submitted, the court took them and then just asked them without calling the parties up. At that point, after a recess was called after that witness, the defense attorney said, hold on, Judge, you know, I've never done one of these cases with jury questions, and I think I need a chance to look at those questions before you ask them. And according to the defense, no, my duty is to look at them, and if I think they're proper questions, I'm going to ask it. Then you can object. And the defense attorney said, well, you know, that's not going to work because the juror is going to think I don't like their question and I'm concerned about it. And the judge said, well, you know, too bad. I already told him it's your duty to object. And at that point, the defense attorney said, well, then I object to any jury questions being asked. And the court said, well, no, actually, it's mandated now under the rule.
Ms. Griffin, what?
Just one more. So the particular question that you're objecting to here, I don't remember if it's one or a series, was there an objection made to that question?
No. Yes, go ahead.
I just want to follow up on that question. What was the question and how did it relate to the case, if any?
Yeah. The question was, okay, and it happened after this record was made. It was the housemate was called, and she testified about the fact that there was Mr. Zamarripa Diaz was bleeding from a wound on his head. And she testified about the fact that there was blood in the living areas of the home. But she didn't testify about any blood in either of the bedrooms. And all of the valuable items that had been collected up and put in the hallway by somebody were originally in the bedrooms. So the question from the juror was, well, were there any other things that were marked, or what all, you know, items were marked? And
marked with blood, you're saying? I'm missing something here.
Well, that was what the witness said, marked with blood, and the court said yes. So the court kind of got involved in this and was helping out the juror. And then the witness, for the first time, said, oh, well, there was also blood in these bedrooms, and there was blood in the clothes that were in the rooms, and there was blood in the closet in the bedroom where all of the valuable items had been removed from that were now in the hallway. And prior to that question, there was no blood in those rooms and nothing putting Mr. Zamarripa Diaz in those rooms being the one who collected those items and put them in the hallway. And as the court knows, he was with two other men all that day in the neighborhood. And one of the neighbors had seen all three of them walking toward this house just 10 minutes before Mr. Zamarripa Diaz was later apprehended outside the house. So, you know, the jury may well have had a doubt about whether my client, who was just sort of staggering around drunk, was really the one who was had the presence of mind to go around finding what's valuable and collecting it up, or whether it was his friends who had the presence of mind to leave when they heard the car pull into the driveway. And so the answer to these questions really cemented, I think, for the jury that, well, no, he probably had the intent to steal because it must have been him that was in these bedrooms.
Was the question objectionable?
Right.
And should, regardless of your answer, should that matter to our analysis?
Could you speak up a little louder, too? I'm
sorry.
Having a hard time.
Yeah. The question was objectionable because it reflects prosecution bias. It made the juror an investigator on behalf of the prosecution. It explored this different theory, which was that the blood connects Mr. Zamora Badillas to the stealing, and it answered the doubt that they might have had about this critical issue. Whether it matters...
So before you go on, just to be clear, you're saying the question is objectionable, not for any of the reasons under other circumstances that it would be objectionable, not because it's an evidentiary problem, but rather uniquely because it comes from the juror as opposed to from the prosecutor.
That's the objection that I'm aware of. Well, and because of the nature of the question. Yeah. I mean, I don't have a rule of evidence, if that's...
But if the question had been asked by the prosecutor, it wouldn't have been objectionable, right?
I'm not aware of the objection.
Okay.
I mean, that's the prosecutor's job. And the jury, unfortunately, was doing it. And the court kind of injected himself into it as well. Whether it needed to be objectionable, I don't think so. Because the procedure enacted by the court was in violation of due process by requiring the defense attorney to have to choose between alienating the jurors by objecting or foregoing his objections. That procedure violates due process. And I think it would probably be more clear to the court if this were a case where the defense attorney had objected and had suffered that potential jury anger or alienation. And even if he had objected whether or not the objection was meritorious or valid, it might be more clear to the court that the attorney had actually suffered that effect from the procedure. But be that as it may, the procedure itself was improper and violated Mr. Zamora Padilla's due process.
Can I just reiterate, do I understand that your position is, first of all, that this amounts to reverse structural error, right, reversible error, because of the process that the judge asked the question, which is not objectionable for evidentiary reasons, because the juror asked it. Is that what you're really saying?
It's not any question that was asked by a juror, but the nature of these questions, I think, because they were adversarial, and because the goal of the question was to help the prosecution fill the gap, make the link, prove the case.
Isn't that objection sort of subsumed in the decision in Medina that the process is constitutional? I mean, doesn't, you don't think Medina foresees that if jurors are allowed to ask questions, that they might aid one side or the other?
Well, I think there is a line that can be crossed, and I think even the pilot project recognized that when it, in the appendix to my reply brief, if you look at what the court's supposed to look at in deciding if the questions are admissible, one of the factors is whether the juror is becoming allied with one side, if the questions are too adversarial, or if they're, basically, if they're introducing a new theory or helping out too much. And in this case, you know, the concern that was expressed by Justice Coates in the dissent to Medina comes out, because in this case, the court is helping to shape the juror question in a way that really helped the prosecution. The court didn't ask the juror, do you mean marked with blood? The court just assumed that was what was meant and said, yes, that was what was meant. If the court doesn't have any other questions, I'll save my time. Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee, on behalf of people, bar number 38141. Justice Martinez, I'd like to begin with one of your questions, which is, was there any direct evidence presented at trial that supports the flailing of the arms theory that the defendant now pursues on appeal? And what's absolutely critical here is no, there was no evidence at all presented. So on the first issue, my position is straightforward. The defendant cannot establish plain error because their theory is based on nothing more than speculation. Now, their argument, as I understand it, is that the acquittal first instruction may have coerced the jury's verdict because one of the jurors may have been coerced into going up and convicting on first-degree burglary. Their claims, I understand it, is that a juror may have felt that the defendant was more guilty of second degree because the acquittal first instruction required them to acquit unanimously before considering it, rather than holding out that juror voted up. And I think it's important to point out just how many steps and inferences we have to take to get there. First, we have to assume that the jury rejected the victim's testimony. And I'd like to read from the record briefly just to clear up some of the factual disputes that were raised during defense counsel's arguments. This is in volume 3, page 123, and this was the only testimony we had regarding the assault. So did he swing at you with his right hand? Answer, yes. And was that open hand closed fist? Answer, it was a closed fist. How close did it come to hitting you? Answer, if I didn't make an evasive move, it would have made contact with me. Question, what part of you? Answer, probably face. Question, describe how hard the swing was. Was it a jab? Was it a roundhouse? Answer, it would have been more like a straight jab. It was like a swing. Question, how about the amount of force that it came at you? Answer, pretty forceful. Yes. So in order for us to make the first jump in the defendant's theory, we have to assume that the jury rejected this testimony, that the defendant forcefully swung at her face, and absent her evasive action, he would have hit her. This conclusion also requires us to assume that the jury arrived at this conclusion, even though it was never argued below. Defense counsel never argued that the jury should look at this evidence and find that the defendant was just flailing his arms about. As this court will recall, defense counsel actually conceded during closing argument that the defendant was guilty of third-degree assault, that he did swing at the victim. So as a result from those two steps, if we can make all those steps, the defendant argument requires us then to find that rather we're left with a juror who thinks that the defendant's more guilty of second-degree burglary. But we again have to assume, rather than holding out, voting not guilty, the juror then is going to just go with the majority and say guilty.
Well, I thought the argument was on serious bodily injury.
That was the argument presented below, yes.
Pardon me?
That was the argument pursued below.
Well, I mean, I thought the defense argument was here this morning was that there was not overwhelming evidence of serious bodily injury, that the punch was an attempt to inflict serious bodily injury. I thought that was her argument.
I think that's one of their arguments. I know in the brief they pursued both, but to answer your question, there's no evidentiary basis in the record beyond what I just read. So anything else, I think, would just be speculation.
Well, so is that overwhelming evidence of guilt?
It is in this context because there's no contrary evidence.
Okay.
I believe. I think as this court made clear in Wilson, and then I'll also talk about Kaufman and Ahman, when we're put in a position when we're reviewing a verdict, kind of like this, in an error, the one thing we can't do, the one thing that definitely does not establish plain error, is when it's just based on speculation. So here we have evidence, and as the Court of Appeals found, evidence that is, as a matter of law, sufficient to support the verdict.
Well, what's a little bit unusual about the facts in this case is that the victim actually apparently tries to subdue the defendant. I thought that was a fact, right?
It is.
Put one of his arms in some sort of armhole behind his back, and then presumably swings with the other arm. Do we know that kind of thing?
That is how the facts were at trial, but I think that only be a concern for us if self-defense was an issue, but it wasn't. Because she had a lawful right to try to detain someone who's inside her home. So the fact that what she did to before him, that's completely irrelevant, I think, to the issues we have on appeal.
Well, I thought the defense argument was that he was just trying to, you know, to the extent he was capable of trying anything, was just trying to get out of there and flailing around.
And I guess my contention is I think that's a dual mental state. Regardless of why he's trying to hit her, that's sufficient to establish it. If he wants to hit her and hurt her because he also wants to get out, that's not exclusive with the intent that he wants to cause her serious bodily injury or put her in fear of it. If anything, I think they're related, and that actually buttresses the conclusion.
Could I ask a question? I didn't check out the instructions in this, and I missed a little bit of all the connection. But you're arguing about menacing as the difference between first degree and second degree burglary. Was the jury instructed with regard to assault, as the statute would have allowed, that would also elevate a second degree burglary to a first degree burglary? Was that an issue here? Or are we just arguing about whether there was what the evidence was of menacing, and therefore serious bodily injury?
I think he was just menacing, and therefore it is only serious bodily injury.
So when you described what happened, you talked about in terms of an assault, but for purposes of whether this was plain error, are we only concerned then with, as your opposing counsel said, whether the jury, whether there was overwhelming evidence or the jury surely would have found menacing and therefore the intent to commit serious bodily injury? We're not concerned with separately whether simply the evidence was overwhelming of an assault.
Yes. Let me correct your honor.
Okay.
And I think what really makes this case different from cases like Hoffman and Allman, where this court did find plain error, is the nature of the instruction we have here. It's not something that foreclosed a verdict. In Kaufman and Allman, assuming the jury did believe the defendant's theory, did believe the defense evidence, they were foreclosed or precluded from finding for the defendant. Here, the instruction did not it hindered but did not preclude the jury from doing a finding. And I think it's important to find out that assuming all this is based on the idea that a juror was coerced into going up when they might have gone down. And I think presumably, if that had been the case, there might actually be some evidence in front of us that would support that. One, the length of the jury deliberation. Here, I think it was under 2 hours. Two, what questions did the jury ask during deliberations? Here, they asked questions, but nothing about menacing or serious bodily injury. So, based not only on the evidence, but also on what we know about how the jury deliberated to the extent we can know anything, there's just absolutely no indication at all that this was an issue. And as this court made clear in Wilson, when we have nothing but speculation, and here I would submit it's speculation on top of speculation, there's just no basis for plain error.
Can I ask one follow-up on that? Your opposing counsel talked about the prosecutor's closing argument and the emphasis it placed on acquittal. Do you recall that part of the closing argument, and could you tell us what that was about? And in conjunction with that, was the prosecutor arguing some specific reason why they shouldn't acquit? Was that in conjunction specifically with discussion of the menacing situation?
My memory, it was a very quick statement. So the prosecutor was making his argument to the jury, saying this is the only evidence we have. So we strongly submit that you can find defendant guilty first-degree burglary. And then I think his direct words were, but if you don't think it's that, you don't have to let him go. You could also convict him of second-degree burglary. And if you don't believe that, you can go even one step further, and you can convict him of first-degree criminal trespass.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. In addition to the error not being substantial, we would also ask this court to affirm on the obviousness ground that the error here wasn't obvious at the time of trial. The defendant in the reply brief argues that this question is not proper before the court because when you review a cert question, it has to be read in the context of the cert petition and the headings of the Court of Appeals opinion. I think that ignores the plain language of Rule 53A, which plainly provides, quote, "The statement of an issue will be deemed to include every subsidiary issue clearly comprised therein." And the cert question granted here was whether there was reversible plain error. And as the defendant puts on page 6 of their opening brief, reversible plain error involves both obvious and substantial errors. And it's our position that the error here was not obvious at the time of trial, because before the Court of Appeals case, no court had ever held that the acquittal first instruction was error if it's working to the defendant's benefit or it appears to be his strategy. We basically have three cases on this issue. The very first case in Colorado dealing with the acquittal first instruction was McGregor. And in McGregor, because of the facts of that case, they didn't have to reach it because they found that the instruction did not create an acquittal first problem, but noted that two cases in Michigan had found it to be plain error. Later, this court came out with Padilla. And in Padilla, this court, again, didn't have to reach it as a factual matter, but held that it was persuaded by the reasoning of the Second Circuit in Zanis, which held that when it works to the defendant's benefit, the defendant should be allowed to elect whether he wants the hard transition or the soft transition approach. We then have Bachaca, which is the case of the Court of Appeals.
Excuse me, what about the statement in that opinion that Colorado follows the soft transition?
In Richardson, yes. It was in a footnote, and I think it was in the context, and I could be wrong, of just what's the default. And I think it's a very different question of if the defendant wants one rather than the other, is he entitled to have it? And if he elects it, is the trial court in error in letting him have what he wants?
But your argument here at this point is that this was not obvious error because nobody could have foreseen it coming?
It's not obvious because I think our law, we have, one, no holding on it, and two, to the fact that the trial court had any direction, I think under Padilla it suggested that it did the right thing.
I didn't follow that part of your argument. Why did it do the right thing?
Well, because in Padilla, I think that's the closest case we have. This court, again, they didn't have to reach the issue as a factual matter, but they did know that they rejected the line of cases that McGrady relied on, those Michigan cases. But it held that it was persuaded by the reasoning in Zanez that when the defendant wants one of these instructions as opposed to the other, he should be able to choose.
Well, I don't quite understand your position. Is your position that you weren't entitled to a soft transition?
My position is that the way I read the record is,
the record. I want to know what the state of law is. What's your position on the state of law?
In
Colorado, historically, are you entitled to, as a defense, are you entitled to soft transition instruction?
Yes, but I also think you're entitled to hard instruction if you want it.
Excuse me?
I also think you're entitled to the hard or acquittal first instruction.
Well, defendants can always waive rights, right?
Yes.
All right. So is your position that it's not error?
My position
is... To give a hard instruction when the soft instruction should be given? I don't understand that. I mean, I did this for 30 years. I can never, ever remember not having a soft instruction.
My position would be it's not error. And I would cite the court for the Second Circuit case. How it works normally is, and I think this is kind of what this record shows, you give the jury both the instructions with the hope that although the evidence may be clear for the greater, you might be able to convince one or two of the jurors of the lesser. The fact that it requires them to unanimously acquit before they can move down, you hope creates a holdout. And if you get a holdout, then the case has to get dismissed if you can get the deadlock. And then either the prosecution either plea bargains or they dismiss the case, rather than going through the process of another trial.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard many defense lawyers give that theory?
Of the four cases cited in the brief, it would be in the Second Circuit. I mean, I actually haven't heard a lot of defense lawyers give the soft approach either, to be honest with you. So I can really give no info to the court on which is the preferred method. But I think it's suffice to say that, at least in terms of case law, courts have found that sometimes this instruction works to the defendant's benefit. And I think it's important to recall here that the defendant tendered two instructions, the second-degree burglary and the first-degree criminal trespass, and only one of these instructions had that language. They were allowed to consider...
And there were two bridging... The question that Justice Martinez asked, there were two bridging instructions, one for the LIO and one for the lesser non-included?
My memory is there's no bridging instruction, just it's on the bottom of each verdict form. And they were explicitly advised by the court, the prosecutor, and defense counsel that they consider first-degree criminal trespass at any time.
I'm confused here. Are you saying defense counsel submitted the verdict forms?
Or the instructions on the elements. Or that's what the defense said in their reply brief, at least.
The defense submitted these instructions?
On the lesser included, yes.
Okay.
No, but wait a minute. I don't want to get confused about this again. Isn't that the instruction, to consider a lesser included, which is really not our concern here at all? The instruction as to how it should be considered that made it appear that, that we're our hard transition state, which I don't think we are, that instruction was on the verdict form itself. And that verdict form was not tendered by the defense. Is that correct, or am I still misunderstanding?
You know, Judge, I'm really not sure. It was my recollection from the record that it was unclear. What we had a jury conference where the attorneys just made their objections, and the prosecutor said that he objected to these two instructions in verdict forms. The defense says in the reply brief that it was the defendant who tendered these instructions.
So there's no record as to whether the defense tendered the verdict form, which has the objectionable instruction.
That was my recollection, but I think the defendant in the reply brief said it was them. So to the extent, I would ask this court to check the record, and if that's true, of course, then...
Of course, counsel here said the opposite, so you're saying that...
Oh, well, then I could be mistaken.
Counsel is contradicting herself?
No, I might be the one who's making this messier than it has to be. It was my recollection that the defendant tendered the two, or it was unclear from the record, but I thought in the reply brief the defendant said that they had. I apologize, I can give you no better direction than that. But I think regardless of how and when, I think if we look at the way that the theories were pursued below, that it wouldn't have been obvious to the trial judge at the time that the defendant didn't want the hard transition for this one defense. And as a result, I submit that's not fair. So turning to the second issue, we just asked this court to affirm the rule as written. I think Rule 24G was the paradigmatic attempt of this court to explain how jurors should ask questions of witnesses in criminal trials. It did not adopt the procedures of the pilot project, nor that of other jurisdictions. And when the Court of Appeals here reviewed the trial court's procedure, it just applied the rule as plainly written, which I think makes a lot of sense, as I argued in our answer brief. I think the defendant's submission today on why it's prejudicial is that it chills attorneys' objections because they're afraid that the jury's going to hold grudges should they object to a juror's question. I think that the danger in that is very low. As the studies and research provides, there's really no indication that jurors hold grudges. And in fact, I think our system is kind of built around the idea that we can give juries instructions and they can understand and apply those instructions, as we do here.
Do you have any comment, Mr. Lee? Justice Coates wrote an interesting concurring opinion to Medina, where he noted that partiality by a questioner is potentially an evasion of due process. And I'm wondering, what about the comment by the judge for helping answering the question initially? What did you, that Ms. Griffin discussed? What is your view of that?
Well, my view is, first, I think facially we can't really say that's partial because the judge and the juror in asking the question doesn't know what the answer is going to be. So, I mean, just as it's helpful to us, had it been in the negative, it would have been helpful to the defendant. So I think when we're looking at the question,
the answer wasn't, I guess, helpful to the defendant, right?
The answer was not helpful to the defendant, no. But I think
we're looking at a past record, you know, not.
Well, okay, let me answer two ways then. I think first, I mean, what we're concerned with when we're looking at the question is the question. Does the question show that the juror or the judge has become so in favor of the prosecution that it's no longer a fair trial? And I think, you know, this question here, it doesn't show that. Because depending on what the answer was, which no one could have known what it was besides the witness, it doesn't show that kind of partiality. Two, to the extent that I think someone in some instances would show a partiality that would render it a due process violation, the correct remedy isn't to screen that question outside the presence of counsel. I mean, it'd be to excuse that juror.
Well, at that point in the trial, I think that would be a mistrial.
Maybe mistrial. And I mean, this is what the court said in Medina. I mean, and again, I want to be clear that I don't think that this question at all showed a prosecutorial bias mandating such a drastic remedy. But I'm saying, to the extent that this court is asking, what happens when a juror or the court shows such a partiality to one side that the trial can no longer be fair? I don't think the proper remedy is to screen the questions outside of the jury and object outside of their presence. I mean, the proper remedy would be, as this court said in Medina, would be a mistrial or excusing the juror and replacing them with an alternate. So, although I think there's very little propensity that the procedure used here was prejudicial. I also want to point out, as I did in the answer brief, that I think there's a lot of benefits to the procedure that the court used. And I think that's kind of I'm hoping that's what this court was thinking when they wrote the rule the way they did. One of the benefits is the whole purpose behind this is to actively engage juries. We want them to be actively engaged with the trials and ask questions. That can be better suited by making trials more efficient. Some of the studies show that when trials go too long or the juries think that it's becoming too burdensome, they're going to be less likely to actively engage in trial. So I think the way, in cases like this, where the questions are relatively simple, the legal and evidentiary disputes are very minor, I don't think it makes a lot of sense to every time usher out the jury and ask the questions outside of them, when for the most part the questions, as they were here, are going to be right on point. Second, in more complicated cases, I think this procedure is helpful because if it allows juries to ask questions during examination, that way they can better understand difficult concepts right away, and it can signal attorneys which areas they need to go to in order to clean up the issues. And then just turning briefly to, I think, some of the questions this court asked at the end, regardless of where this court comes out on the substantive issue of whether this process should or should not be part of the rule, the defendant just can't show prejudice. First of all, their argument below and here was that it prejudices the defense because they're forced to object in front of the jury. Well, defense counsel never objected here, so they suffer no prejudice there. So the only cognizable claim is, if they had objected, assuming they had objected, would the court have sustained the objections? And here, the court wouldn't have. As this court made clear in Medina, the fact that a question may show prosecutorial bias or may get out facts that favor the prosecution, that's not a basis for an objection. So here, even if they had objected, the question still would have been asked. So I don't think the defendant can show any prejudice at all. Additionally, the evidence is cumulative. As far as the blood goes, there's evidence presented before the question was asked that there was blood in the garage, all over the house, and in the basement. The jury question did not add a lot to where the blood was. So we would ask this court to affirm the procedure as the trial court authorized, and also, in any event, it was completely harmless regardless. And this court has no further questions. I ask you to affirm. Thank you.
I think I can get us a little bit closer to the answer to the question of who tendered the verdict, because what happened was defense counsel asked for second-degree burglary as a lesser-included class 4 felony, second-degree burglary of a structure. The prosecution wanted second-degree burglary of a dwelling, which was an extra element. We objected to that. We said we don't want that. That's an extra element. It wasn't charged. The court disagreed and said, no, I'm giving the prosecutors lesser included. So we wanted the lesser because we wanted the backup. But we didn't want the prosecutor's lesser. So the verdict was the prosecutor's verdict. It had the extra element of the dwelling. Also, and that's the conference in volume 4, right around page 27, 28
of the record. Oh, wait a minute. When you say it was the prosecutor's verdict, you are assuming that, essentially, from the fact that the prosecutor wanted that lesser.
It was the prosecutor's version of the lesser. We didn't want that version of the lesser.
But that still doesn't really tell us anything about who tendered the verdict for him, does it?
Yes.
I think it makes it pretty clear, because I don't think the defense attorney would have been preparing the prosecutor's instructions.
Well, it makes that unlikely, but it may have been the court.
Well, that's
true. I'm sure the court gave the verdict form to both lawyers and said, can you object to anything that's here? Well, that's on the record, isn't it? I never tried a case where the judge didn't say that. I would have liked it, because it would be reversed. Right? I mean.
Well, right. It wasn't. I mean, it's not objected to. That's established.
Excuse me, counsel. Time is expired.
Thank you. I just ask you to reverse.
May I have the court thank counsel for the argument and what we're being received.